Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love, live at the Provincetown Film Festival.
Recently, we brought Modern Love to the Provincetown Film Festival in Provincetown, Massachusetts. The show featured some incredible stories, including one by Rachel Monroe called My Backseat View of a Great Romance. It was performed by Chloe Grace Moretz, who starred in If I Stay, Carrie, and Clouds of Sils Maria. And this summer, you can see her in The Miseducation of Cameron Post. Here's Chloe.
Hi. My plan was to go to Morocco to escape romance, not learn a lesson in it. I had been awarded a prestigious research grant, and the year-long stint an ocean away seemed the perfect excuse to finally break up with my sort of boyfriend. Though we lived on opposite coasts, this boyfriend-type person and I had been together for more than 2 years, and I'd been fighting it the whole time. Being a girlfriend seemed so old-fashioned. Well, and besides, it made me behave in ways I disapproved of. I needed him in my life, and I resented that fact. In my early 20s, wasn't I supposed to be careless and uncommitted? With the trip looming, we decided, at my urging, to break up for real this time. I thought I would feel liberated. Instead, I spent my days mooning around the house, crying, or baking to distract myself from crying. I forced myself to remember that, well, this was exactly what I wanted. After all, love was so flimsy when held up against virtues like independence and freedom. So why did it feel like a vestigial arm, something fused onto me that I couldn't get rid of no matter how hard I tried? In the end, well, the breakup didn't stick, and we left things ambiguous. My first night in Morocco, I lay in a narrow hotel bed, and I listened to the rush and sounds outside. Even the traffic noise sounded fresh and thrilling. I envisioned days spent exploring markets and conducting research, deliciously independent. Instead, I became addicted to cynical Peace Corps volunteers, none of whom stuck around for more than a week or two. At night, when loneliness enveloped me, I would Skype the unboyfriend. I was never good at figuring out the time difference, but he answered my calls, even at 5 a.m. As a distraction, I threw myself into my research. I had come to Morocco to study first-generation literacy in teenage girls, and a contact suggested that I begin work in Amzmez, a small town at the foothills of the Atlas Mountains, not far from my home base in Marrakesh. The family I stayed with there was poor, even by the standards of that rural town. And still, they were amazingly welcoming. Fatima Zora, at 20, was the oldest daughter, and she soon adopted me as her special charge. After a tour of the town, Fatima Zora took me to her favorite spot, a hill, dotted with scrappy goats and glum-looking cows. We talked about school, cooking, hairstyles, and Jackie Chan. She was a very big fan. After a lull in the conversation, she looked up at me shyly, and I had a feeling I knew it was coming. "Are you in love?" she asked. The last two words in English. She preferred English for most love words. She had clearly been studying all those romantic comedies that I had studiously avoided. I tried to convey my answer. "Well, I don't know, probably not. I mean, what is love, really?" in the awkward mix of French and Arabic that was our means of communication. And at the time, I thought it was my butchered language that disappointed her. Now, I wonder if she did understand me, and it was my dithering that left her cold. "What about you?" I asked, not expecting much of an answer. As far as I could tell, she was a shy girl who rarely left the house, and the relatively strict gender segregation meant that Amzmez was hardly a hotbed for teenage romance. "I have a friend," she said. And from the way she said it, blushing wildly, unable to look me in the eye, well, it was clear that she was far more certain about this friend than I was about my boyfriend-type person. Over the next day or two, she told me all about him. Jawad drove a grand taxi, which meant that he traveled a fixed route between Amzmez and a tinier town about 20 kilometers away. Fatima Zora had run literacy classes in that town and had come to know Jawad as a weekly commute. Moroccan grand taxis typically squish about 6 passengers plus a driver into a regular-sized sedan, so they never had much privacy. Somehow, though, they had come to an understanding. And no, her parents did not know. They would never approve. She asked if I would help her see him, and of course I agreed. I was all for the drama of an illicit rendezvous, especially when it wasn't mine. That evening, according to the plan concocted by Fatima Zora and her sister Ahmel, I insisted that Fatima Zora escort me to the town's ramshackle internet cafe so I could check my email. It sounded a little far-fetched, but apparently the idea of an internet-addicted American was believable enough to buy us an hour or two of unsupervised time. We immediately headed for an isolated road where Jawad knew to meet us. When he finally arrived in his battered white taxi, the sun had begun to set. He leaned his head out the window and waved wildly. He had impish eyebrows and a grin just as big as Fatima Zora's, if not bigger. I decided I approved of the match. I climbed into the back seat and we sped off. Before long, Jawad turned onto a dirt path and he parked in the middle of a field dotted with wildflowers. I was wondering whether we'd be going on a walk in the woods when, without further ado, the canoodling commenced in the front seat. My assumptions about Fatima Zora's sheltered life had been way off. That morning, I never would have predicted that my demure, hijab-wearing friend would sneak away to make out in her boyfriend's car. Curled up in the back seat, I pretended to be interested in the scenery. But years of living in a tiny house with no doors, it must have been nearer to Fatima Zora from embarrassment. She giggled and snuggled in the front, as if I weren't there at all. I eventually relaxed and I allowed myself to snoop. They were cute, absurdly so. Jawad seemed like a tender type, a forehead kisser, a cheek caresser. He kept going. She tickled him. They brought their heads together and whispered romantic things. Lovelorn Lebanese pop singers moaned on the radio. And outside, the evening flickered with fireflies. It was way too adorable to be true. But here it was, happening right before my eyes. About half an hour of PG-rated nuzzling, it was time to head back. The brief visit made Fatima Zora giddy for the rest of the weekend, and I was pleased to have played a role. As our internet cafe ploy became routine over several months, I found myself in the strange position of being not just a chaperone, but, well, a secret advocate for romance. I kept waiting to be soured by all the longing and adoration, but this love stuff was increasingly addictive. My visits to Amzmez became something to look forward to, and I was happy to obsess over each delicious nuance with Fatima Zora and her sister. The best were the taxicab evenings, dates I could attend, but did not have to participate in. Despite my newfound begrudging appreciation of love, things with the unboyfriend were as prickly as ever. I didn't want to lose my most loyal caller, my secret keeper, my funny friend. But I didn't want to be with him either. So I vacillated. That was unfair. I said cruel things. And then I would call him crying when the next wave of loneliness hit. Things seemed to be going well in Amsmez until one day in April, when a man at a cafe spotted Fatima Zora and Jawad looking cozy and reported them to her father. Though generally an easygoing man, he blew up at the news. When Fatima Zora claimed she wanted to marry Jawad, he insisted that it was impossible. She was too beautiful to be married off to such a poor man. She needed someone who would provide a better life for her and her family. "You can't feed yourself with love," he shouted. "But you can't buy love," she shouted back. And after that, she was under virtual house arrest. Worse, she didn't see or speak to Jawad for 2 weeks, and, well, she was afraid that he would forget her. I worried that someone would notice my sudden lack of interest in the internet cafe. But the family was too listless to even care. The situation was resolved in a spectacular manner. On a day when Fatima Zora's father had traveled to Marrakesh for work, Ahmel had a seizure. There was no money in the house and no way to take her to the doctor. Panic, Fatima Zora called Jawad, who swooped to the rescue, delivering the family to the hospital and even spending his own meager salary on the necessary medications for her. His white knight act immediately endeared Jawad to the family, and Fatima Zora's father agreed to their engagement. If I had seen it in a movie, I would not have believed it. Hearing it recounted by Fatima Zora, well, I cried. After that, things changed. Fatima Zora was busy planning her engagement party. She developed a swift and exclusive friendship with Jawad's sister. And now it was usually the two of them conferring in a corner about womanly things. I spent most of my time back in Marrakesh, lonely in a different way than I had been at the arrival 8 months before. At least I had overcome my ambivalence to the cliches of love. But what did it mean that the most romantic thing I'd ever been a part of hadn't even happened to me? Ordinarily, I would have called the unboyfriend so he could talk me through it. But somehow, I knew I would have to handle this alone. For weeks, I turned over the problem in my head before admitting what had to be done. Dialing the unboyfriend's number, I held the image of Fatima Zora and Jawad beaming at each other in the taxi, wholeheartedly sure of each other. And when I told the unboyfriend we needed to end things, he became very quiet. Something in my voice must have told him that it was real this time. In a way, it was my own version of the grand romantic gesture. The best way I knew to honor love. There was still something between us, friendship, inside jokes, a closeness born of many crises suffered together. But whatever we had, it was unfair to call it love.
Chloe Grace Moretz, everybody. I was utterly transported during your read of that. I could see the two of them, or the three of them, I should say, in the car
together. Yeah, the three of them.
Why did you choose this one to read?
I think it was just a different telling of love than I had seen. I think it was one of the most honest references, I think, to that moment in your life when you realize that the love that you think is love because you say I'm in love isn't love. And it's only when you see that in the reflection of someone who is truly and deeply in love with someone that you realize that it's okay to admit that what you have currently is not true love. And that's okay, and that's really strong to admit. So I chose that.
Thank you so much. You. Chloe Grace Moretz, everybody.
Stay with us. We talk with the author of this essay, Rachel Monroe, after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Rachel Monroe left Morocco in 2007 and didn't have a way to stay in touch with Fatima Zora and her family after that. None of them had email or Facebook accounts. But about a year after her piece came out, she traveled back to Morocco to visit them and to give the family half of the money she'd made from her essay.
And I wasn't even really sure that I would remember how to get back to their house, and they didn't have like a street name and an address in that way. I just would have to navigate it kind of by feel and muscle memory. But I remembered how to get back there, and I knocked on the door, and I remember their mother just looked at me with this look of real shock and surprise. And actually, she had said that her husband had just been talking about me that morning, and then I appeared, which I think was really shocking for them.
Fatima Zora came over to see Rachel during that visit, and she brought her new baby.
She was mostly really happy. I mean, it wasn't sort of a fairy tale. Everything in her life was beautiful and wonderful, but she was still happily married. She and Jawad still seemed to really get along. She was so happy to be a mother. She was, as many young women in these towns in Morocco do, she was living with her in-laws. And I know there was a little bit of friction there. And she was still dreaming. She was dreaming about opening a hotel. But it was nice to know that they had made it work, and they still seemed to get kind of googly-eyed about each other.
That was almost 10 years ago. Since then, Rachel hasn't been able to stay in touch with the family, so she's not sure how they're doing now. But she says she'd love to go back and see them someday. Rachel is occasionally in touch with the unboyfriend, and she told us that there was another part of the story that she didn't write about in her essay, which was that her unboyfriend had actually moved to Morocco during her fellowship.
I had done a sort of typically ambivalent move where I had said something like, well, there's this job that you could take here in Morocco, and you could be here and we could hang out, but don't move here for me, which was the sort of unkind position that I would put him in a lot. And so we moved to Morocco, and he ended up staying there for several years after I had left, and was a teacher and mentored a bunch of students and had his own adventures.
The unboyfriend is married now. He and Rachel have a good relationship, which she says she's deeply grateful for.
To me, it kind of feels like the happy ending is the fact that my friendship with him has maintained, even despite being young and ambivalent and confused and terrible, but that connection persists and that he forgave me for all that. To me, that's like really, really profound and really meaningful.
Rachel is a writer living in Marfa, Texas now. She loves it, but says that dating there can be tough.
Very small town. Everybody, it's like about the size of the high school that I went to, and there are certainly comparisons that could be made between the Marfa dating scene and a high school dating scene.
She also says that it can be easy to become cynical about love.
But I do think that there is something in maintaining some maybe irrational optimism and belief in an idea that love can be something grand and that it can make you better than yourself. I spent a lot of time stuck in a place where I was like, well, I don't believe in grand romance, and I think I maybe could have been better served by having a little bit more idealism in there.
We've got more after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
Well, one thing I've learned in 14 years or so of editing Modern Love is that Americans can have a real problem with romance, that they crave it, but they also can feel like they're too cool for it. And Rachel's essay just got at the heart of that. It's one of the few Modern Loves where it's almost completely observational, and it's how their story illuminates her own sort of backseat story. And it's humbling for her to realize that these people, you know, in the countryside of Morocco have it all over her when it comes to romance and love.
Next week, part two of our live show from the Provincetown Film Festival with Corey Michael Smith.
To access the site, you typed in your username in the blank field, waited for a slot to open, and then found yourself in the main chat room where you could challenge people to a round of blackjack, keno, or billiards. Except it seemed no one else was there to play those games seriously. The screen was a constant stream of dirty messages. I realized no one wanted to message with a boy in his early adolescence, but many were clamoring to chat with an attractive woman. And that's where Pamela came in. To interest fellow gamers, I needed to become a woman.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. Original scoring and live sound design by Matt Reed. Special thanks to Lisa Viola, Joanne Rivera, Julie Rocket, and the whole team at the Provincetown Film Festival, and Scream Along with Billy. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.